Good morning and welcome to The Morning Voice. I am Dr. Ed Ackerley. We got a full house today. In the studio with us is my brother, Bill Ackerley. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
And Adam is also here. Adam is our Morgan Murphy duplicate. What's that when you have a twin that's the doppelganger? Yeah, that's a doppelganger.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Adam, and thanks for being here. Couple things here. Just first off, we've got the Coaches for Charity Bowl-a-thon tomorrow, right, Bill? That's happening tomorrow at 10, right?
Yeah, 10 a.m. at Lucky Strike Bowl over there on Speedway at 415 East Speedway.
Right, and we got 12 lanes of bowlers going, and we got silent auction and 50-50
draw. 50-50 raffle, yes.
Yeah, so a lot going on. Should be fun. That goes from 10 to noon tomorrow. So,
right, and we're raising money for Drachman Montessori K-8 Magnet School sports equipment.
Right, so we try and get them a couple $1,000 to buy some equipment to supplement what the coaches kind of have to pull out of their pocket to help their little team. So,
right.
So we'll see if we can get them some money. And if you're interested, you want to get some more information, give Matt a call at 790-2040, 520-790-2040. He can write down your number, and Bill and I'll get back to you here later in the day. Sunday is Father's Day. Amazingly, happy Father's Day to anybody that's going to be celebrating. All of us will be celebrating because we all have fathers. If you want something unique for your dad, go to Young Donuts Rise and Shine Donuts and get him some donuts, or get him a cinnamon roll that's the size of a plate, a dinner plate. It's the most amazing thing. It's a gigantic cinnamon roll. He'll love it, but you got to stop by Rise and Shine and see Terry and Robert tomorrow by 3 p.m. on Saturday because they're closed on Sunday. But go get a cinnamon roll and give it to your dad on
Speedway
Father's
and Cold.
Day. Speedway and Cold. Yep, exactly. So delicious. And then a reminder that our next eat and greet is Thursday, June 26th from 5:30 to 7 at Casa del Rio Restaurant and Cantina. Morning Voice host will be there. That'll be Lydia Aranda, Ted Maxwell, Grant Kruger, Tom Moulton, and myself, and Matt Neely will be there. And you should be there, too, because it's fun. That's Thursday, June 26th, 5:30 at Casa del Rio, located at 22nd in Pantano. So we got a lot going on today. Our first guest for Business Success Story is Seebok Blue Norish from Shaolin Kung Fu Academy. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
That is a mouthful. Shaolin Kung Fu Academy. That's great. Give us a little background on your experience and how you landed as the director of Shaolin Kung Fu Academy on Fort Lowell.
Yeah, so I started studying Kung Fu specifically at my school, Shaolin Kung Fu Academy and Girl Power, when I was 5 years old. I have been studying on and off since then, mostly on and off throughout my childhood, but consistently since I was about 15 years old. Mm-hmm. I'm 30 now, so a really long time. And my teachers, who became second parents to me very quickly when I was little, founded the school in 1999, and they created this incredible, vibrant, loving, wonderful environment for kids that I just clung to. And throughout my life,
clung to kung fu. Okay, that's great. You clung to kung fu. I like that.
Now that's
okay.
A mouthful. That's way more of a mouthful than Shaolin Kung Fu. But yeah, so I absolutely loved it, and I like. My whole life was like, I'm never going to do anything else. Like, I'm going to be here forever. And then my world was a little bit rocked when in like 2016, my teachers were like, hey, we are retiring and we are going to move away. Mm-hmm. And that thought like had never occurred to me. I was just like, cool, they're going to be here forever and they're going to be in my life forever. And by retiring, I do use that term really loosely because they're still often and teaching and spreading the word of Shaolin and gathering students wherever they go. But they're off in Europe now and living their best lives. And they handed the school off to my wonderful co-teachers who ran it from 2016 to about 2021 when they too decided that their journey took them elsewhere. They moved out of state. And so we keep it in the family. We don't just kind of, you know, sell off the school. It's something that you know, our studies are a lineage, right? So you learn from a teacher, then you pass it down to your students and pass it down to your students and pass it down to your students. And so when my co-teachers decided that it was their time to move away as well, it was handed over to me. And so I am very, very grateful and very, very honored to be trusted with it, especially having been a part of it since I was so little.
Yeah, but you get the, as I said earlier, you get the challenge of making payroll and making sure the lights stay on and all the administrative tasks that go along with teaching. That's why we talk about business success story.
It's a different beast, for sure.
If we can stay active during that. So one might ask, like me, what is Kung Fu?
So Kung Fu is a form of martial arts that comes from China. It originated in India and was brought to China, and China's kind of where it flourished. So there's a Shaolin monk monastery that is in China, and it is a form of martial arts that focus primarily on self-defense and self-expression. And it is defined primarily by different branches of styles, but what is most known for is its use of hand strikes, kicks, animal styles, and weapons. There's also a distinct use of creative forms within Kung Fu that tends to not be used in other martial arts styles. But it is a more than just a fighting style. It is a way of life, essentially. So at our school, we don't just teach, hey, here's how you hurt people. Mm-hmm. It is a principle of hard work, long practice, which is the direct translation of Kung Fu. So we always say that it's not just about knowing how to hurt people, knowing how to punch and kick. It's about the hard work, long practice, dedication of anything in your life. So our philosophical principles can be applied to hard work, long practice of anything.
Learning how to play an instrument, leadership, exactly. Being a good student.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And so the Shaolin mindset, the Kung Fu mindset, really does trickle into everything that you do once you start to kind of connect the dots. And so some people come just to seek out self-defense, just to seek out learning how to punch and kick, and that's fine. But the people that really, really click with it, really connect with that spiritual mind-body-spirit connection side of things, and that it's a well-rounded study of the self.
Yeah. When before we got on the air, Bill said that you liked the Kung Fu show.
Right. The television show, right.
Yeah. Which kind of, you know, that's silly, but it does kind of show the we were talking about Brian Wilson passing away too, and only of us that are over 30 know who Brian Wilson is and know what the Kung Fu show was. So what inspired you? You said you started when you were about 5, but what inspired you to start and then take those 10 years and then at age 15 really get into it and start teaching it and being absorbed by what it does? What inspired you to study Kung Fu in the first place?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, my mom found the program when I was little. And so inspiring me to study, it wasn't initially my choice, but my mom wanted me to enroll in martial arts. I was a very, very timid, shy child, very like codependent, clung to my parents.
No way.
Well,
and look at you now.
Looking at me now, right? but I.
And we are looking at you now because we're live on Facebook, right? Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
But yeah, so I was very, very like, I always say like borderline mute, like I barely spoke. I didn't have a lot of friends. And my mom really wanted to put me in martial arts, but she had a bad experience with a different martial art when she was a kid that just felt very militant and like drill sergeant-y. Right. And she knew if she put me in something like that, I would just shut down. Right. And so she found a flyer for something that just said girl power. And she was like, this is perfect. And so we went to a class and it was very gentle. It was very inviting. It was very open. But that didn't diminish the discipline aspect of it. It didn't diminish the physical conditioning aspect of it. And she really enjoyed that. And I did too. I took to it really quickly. I felt accepted and loved and appreciated by the teachers and the fellow students. And I had a creative outlet. So as time went on, and you know, when I say I studied on and off, part of that would be like sometimes I would, you know, get burnt out on it, which is normal. And other times my parents just didn't have the means to continue having me practice. But when I turned 15, I kind of rediscovered it. And I also discovered teaching. And there was something about it where I was just like, this is my home. This is really where I feel completely myself. It's a place where I feel that I don't have to pretend to be someone else, or I don't have to, I don't have to feign anything. I just fully get to be myself, and I feel that love and acceptance, and I feel powerful. I feel powerful in my body and my mind and in my words, and I don't feel judged. And it was really just the place where I always felt I could grow. Mm-hmm. And I learned so much physically and mentally. It was just such a loving, wonderful place. And as I got older and as I got more skilled in Kung Fu as well, I truly just like, I know I can walk down the street mm-hmm. and not have to carry mace, not have to carry pepper spray, no shade or anything to people who do. I think those are really wonderful tools, but I just like the empowerment and strength that I feel mm-hmm. walking down the street, knowing that I have the ability to defend myself is priceless.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And I can see how that translates to young kids, especially girls. And we'll talk about that after the break. Our guest is Sebok Blue Norish, who is the director of Shaolin Kung Fu Academy on Fort Lowell. We're live on Facebook today, so if you want to tune into Facebook and see us, you can see how intimidating we are in the studio here today. And if you want to ask a question, you can certainly give us a call at 790-2040, and we'll put you through, and you can ask a question about Kung Fu or anything else today. That would be great. We'll go for a quick break. We'll come back and talk some more about how Kung Fu can help change your life. You're listening to The Morning Voice on KVOI. You got to do that, though, Matt. That was awesome. So thank you. Kung Fu Fighting, I love it. Brings back some memories of the 70s. So, hey, you're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Dr. Ed Ackerley. We're live on camera today on Facebook if you'd like to look us up. And
1030 The Voice is the page.
That's really pretty simple. Or you can give us a call at 790-2040. So we're talking with Sebok Blue Norish, who from Shaolin Kung Fu Academy, and she's the director there, been there for most of her life as a student and now as a teacher and now the director. So she's spent the last 25 years has been kind of at the academy. Good morning again to you.
Thank you.
So what distinguishes Kung Fu from other martial arts like people would be familiar with, like karate or karate and taekwondo?
Yeah, so it's easy to get them all mixed up, right? Especially if you're not familiar with martial arts. But there's a lot of really subtle differences. As probably the most important one is like the country of origin. Mm-hmm. So Kung Fu is from China. Other martial arts like karate is from Japan. Others are from Korea or other Asian countries. But that kind of determines where the martial arts kind of flourished mm-hmm. and then how it spread. Right. So ours is from China. It originated in India and was actually brought to China.
Right.
And then again, what I kind of said earlier is that our martial arts kind of focuses on self-defense. Mm-hmm. And one of those biggest distinguishes for our particular lineage, because there's many different kinds of Kung Fu. So our lineage in particular, a big facet of it is we don't do any sort of competitions or mm-hmm. tournaments. Mm-hmm. So we believe very strongly that Kung Fu is to prolong life, not shorten it.
Right.
And so we don't do anything that is showboaty, competitive, anything like that. And again, it is not to throw shade at anybody who does. Everybody has their own philosophy, and no philosophy in martial arts is the wrong philosophy.
Right.
But ours is very heavily...
it's kind of the way I look at politics. Nobody else is wrong. I'm just right.
There you go. But yeah, it's just essentially that we very much believe in being peacemakers.
Right.
Right. So we do non-contact sparring. We make sure that we are teaching people how to use it for self-defense only.
Right.
We will, you know, vet our students very carefully to make sure that we aren't just like pulling everybody in, mm-hmm. selling belts. We are very strict about who we are teaching this to, because teaching it to the wrong people can have very detrimental mm-hmm. consequences.
And when they graduate to the next belt, they're actually graduating and they've actually got to that point.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. We're not just going, okay, yay, thank you for, you know, your yeah. money. You checked all the boxes. Here's your next belt. Like right. We are very, very firm in stating that we promote people and teach Kung Fu to people who are actively cultivating a peaceful nature. It is deep, deep, deep within our philosophy and deep within our lineage. But specifically for Shaolin Kung Fu, the type of style that I study, it has deep roots in creativity. So there's a lot of creative stylistic forms, which you won't usually see in a lot of other denominations of martial arts, but also we are defined by using strikes, kicks, weapons, and animal styles. Mm-hmm. The animal styles is kind of really what Kung Fu is known for. Mm-hmm. The word Shaolin actually means young pine. So if you think of a young pine tree, the way that it yields to the unyielding and snaps back. So if you like pull a tree and then mm-hmm. let it go, it'll snap. Mm-hmm. That is the way that our style is based on. So we're very quick. We're very snappy. We're very fast and
resilient.
Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. Right. So we don't go towards the opposition. Right. We wait for it to come to us and we make sure that our strikes, you don't see it coming. Mm-hmm. That tends to be the way that our physical style is based on, is a young pine tree.
That's great. I'd like you to give a demonstration on Adam here. So let's Adam stand up and see if she can knock you out here. Our guest is Seebach Blue Norris. She is the director of Shaolin Kung Fu Academy. I want to talk about something pretty cool, which is you have programs for teens and young boys and mm-hmm. even adults and so forth. But you have a special program for girls. Can you tell us about girl power and what that means and what that's about?
Yeah, absolutely. So Girl Power is very, you know, very close to my heart, being that's the program that I started in when I was 5. It started based on the fact that my teacher had 4 daughters. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, he was like, well, I can't follow them all around and make sure that they're safe for the rest of their lives. So I might as well teach them how to defend themselves. And then he really thought about, well, I have a lot more than just 4 daughters that need protection. And he thought about how there is a huge violence disparity in the world amongst girls and women. Mm-hmm. Girls and women are routinely, you know, raped, murdered, assaulted at astronomical levels. And that was something that was an issue that was very close to his heart with, mm-hmm. you know, his mother and his wife and people in his life that he knows that were deeply impacted by violence. And he was like, I want to do something about that.
Right.
And so he created Girl Power, and he had this, you know, this inspiration of this program that was for girls only, to make martial arts more approachable for young girls and teach them how to come into their own power, right? So to not just know how to punch and kick, but also know that they have a power living within them that they can access at any time, that they are capable of defending themselves, not only physically, but mentally and emotionally as well. And so it is a safe space for girls and women to come in and learn how to defend themselves, to express themselves, to be free to find that power. And our motto at the end of every class, which I always love, because I hear the girls when they start and they're very quiet, or sometimes they don't say it, and then by the time they're done with their first session, they're screaming it at the top of their lungs, is, I am special, I am beautiful, I am smart, and I am strong. And it's something I said to myself every day since I was 5. And it truly just, it's my favorite part of the whole
school. That's great. So Shaolin Kung Fu Academy is located on East Fort Lowell. Tell us a little bit about how people can get a hold of you and how can they check out your program, especially Girl Power or for adults or whatever. How do they get a hold of you?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do sessions throughout the year. We take late joiners in the sessions. So regardless of if we have a session going on and you're interested, please contact us. We do free tryout classes as well for both kids, teens, and adults. So if you're interested or have a kiddo who might be interested, give me a call, shoot me a text, or send me an email. Our phone number is 520-548-7090. I take calls and texts. I don't always monitor that phone, though, okay. So please do leave me a voicemail. Yeah, because right. often I'm teaching. Right. So leave me a voicemail. I will get back to you, or shoot me a text. That's usually an easier way to get a hold of me. And then our email address is kungfutucson. That's KUNGFUTUCSON at gmail.com.
Great. You kind of said this already when you talked about girl power, but this is business success. How do you define success?
Good question. So honestly, for myself, I've always defined success as consistent growth. And I feel that that goes kind of hand in hand with the way that we teach as well, is I never want to reach a point where I just go, yeah, I'm done. I'm always learning. I'm always finding ways to incorporate the things that I teach into lessons for myself. Mm. My kids teach me more than I teach them, I think, all of the time. But success for me is constantly moving forward to be able to own up to my mistakes, acknowledge them, and move forward.
Great perspective.
As long as I live.
Great perspective. Thank you, Seebach Blue Norish, director of Shaolin Kung Fu Academy on Fort Lowell. Check them out and see if there's something there for you or your daughter or granddaughter that might be good for you. Thanks for being with us today on The Morning Voice.
Thank you so much, Adam Bill.
To The Morning Voice on KVOI. We'll be back after the break to talk about, we're going to the birds after the break. So you're listening to The Morning Voice.
Don't forget, you can see your voice at 10:30 The Voice on Facebook. Streaming the show live on video.
Welcome back to The Morning Voice, the Tennessee Bird Walk, talking about birds. Hey, we've got the Coaches for Charity Bullathon coming up on tomorrow. Bill, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we're going to have a silent auction, and I'd like to thank some of the people that donated. Janet Hare, Doubletree Hotel, donated two nights. Ed Meyer over at Residence Inns in Tucson Williams Center donated a two-night stay. I'd like to thank Pat Hirsch. She donated a crystal vase, and she's going to have forget-me-not fine floral and gifts fill it up. And then we've got plenty of food gift cards and a lot of things for the silent auction. So that's the second way we raise money for the elementary school sports.
I cleared out my closet and brought it over to you, so yeah. All my gift cards are now in your possession. So that's great.
Yeah, we've got like six restaurants that we have gift cards to.
So. That's great. So if you're interested, stop by 10 to noon tomorrow at Lucky Strike. Hey, it's Father's Day this weekend. If you want something unique, go to Young Donuts and get them a cinnamon roll the size of a plate. And Matt, we have to, don't tell Patty, but we dribbled some donut dust on the ground over here, so just don't tell anybody, okay? Definitely don't tell Bill Buckmaster when he comes in, right? we'll have to get that cleaned up before we leave here. And then a reminder that our next Eat and Greet is Thursday, June 26th from 5:30 to 7 at Casa del Rio Restaurant and Cantina. Kevin Templin and crew will be there, and all of our Morning Voice hosts will be there. Hopefully Matt will be there, and Adam will be there, and Bill will be there. I'll be there.
Should be a margarita.
And yeah, margarita. I dated a girl named Margarita once. No, I'm just teasing. She was kind of salty, though, I have to tell you. But you know what happened? It didn't work out. It was on the rocks. So
thank you.
Oh boy.
Speaking
of Father's Day, those are dad jokes. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's Thursday, June 26th, 5:30 p.m. at Casa del Rio.
You're all shaken up after.
That's a good one. That's a good one. We're talking about success on Fridays and the first hour. And one of the people that has been successful and his family's been successful is Justin Friedman from the Wild Bird Store. Good morning.
Hi there.
You tweet to a different drummer, as they say, right? You're a bird guy. So
That's been said, I think.
Yeah. So tell us, what is the Wild Bird Store?
The Wild Bird Store is a store for feeding wild birds. We make bird feeders and bird foods and sell them for people to enjoy.
And it kind of got started, been family business for a while, so your dad was in it, and then now you guys are doing it?
Yeah. Yep, it was my parents' business, and about a decade ago, my mom passed away, and my dad was diagnosed with an illness where he couldn't lift heavy things, mm-hmm. and every time we'd come visit, he'd be lifting heavy things. So this was kind of like my first job, and my wife worked there when we were younger. Mm-hmm. And so we offered to take it over, and I told him I will take it over. I would rather love you than work for you.
honor him. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's worked out really well.
Yeah. So one of the things you do, obviously, is you make and sell custom bird feeders, and they're waterproof, insect proof, and but I think what's really important is bird friendly. What does bird friendly mean when you have you just don't go to Amazon and buy a bird feeder and bring it home and hope that that works? What does bird friendly mean?
So we have some issues here in Tucson that aren't really widespread in the country as far as birding goes. Like doves, white-winged doves can be a major issue on seed feeders. They'll eat all your food and kind of crowd out your more exotic birds. And don't get me wrong, I love the doves, but I do feed them separately.
Mm-hmm.
So by having a feeder that the doves can't use, your cardinals and all your other birds are a lot happier.
Mm-hmm.
And that really doesn't exist on the market. So, we invented that. And we just kind of find the holes in the market and build things that our customers want.
So not to get into the weeds too much about this, or into the trees, as they say, what makes a bird feeder so that a dove can't get into it, but a cardinal can? Just technically, how would you keep a dove away from something that a cardinal could get into and feed?
So it's by limiting the space for them to land and use the feeder.
Mm-hmm.
And they will use everything that they can. They will not stop trying. They'll eat everything, including like rocks.
Right.
So you have to limit them from the feeder.
I got it. I got it. Okay. And so about 80%, almost all of the things you have in there, you've made and you've created, but you have some others from other people. But a lot of it is stuff that you have created and have on display, right?
80% might be high, but yeah, we make a lot of stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the stuff that we sell that's commercially made is generally like lifetime guaranteed, made in America. Mm-hmm. Products that we know will hold up in Tucson.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is an issue because of the weather, the dryness of the weather, especially if you make something out of wood, it's got to hold up for a long time. And so if you're going to give it a lifetime guarantee, the kind of wood that you use is also important too. What kind of wood do you use?
So we use incense inland cedar, and we've been using it for years. Sometimes we use western cedar, but it's just a really long-lasting, easy to work with, relatively inexpensive wood.
It'll last for a long time in the hot 106 to 110 degrees this weekend. It'll last in that kind of a weather, no problem.
Definitely. We overbuild as well. So, there was like hurricane-force winds a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. I had a feeder blown 40 feet away and barely a little crack in the lid.
Right.
Still using it today. But yeah, if somebody has an issue with their feeder, we'll fix it or replace it.
And so that's kind of what the lifetime warranty is then. If they come and start a bird relationship with you and they buy their feeder from you and you're helping them with feed and so forth, if something happens to the feeder itself, they can bring it back and you can take a look at it and get it fixed up for them.
Oh, yeah. We'll keep them going. I mean, there's many of our feeders out there that are 20 years old at least.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And so we bird friendly is important because it also... the bird wants to use it, right? Because if you have a bird feeder and the bird doesn't want to use it for whatever reason, so bird friendly also means that they want to be attracted to it.
It's true. You know, some of the really prettiest feeders may not be the most effective feeders.
Right. And you may not get that volume of birds and wild birds to come and feed, even though you think you've got seed out there, you've got a bird feeder, but they don't come. They got to want to come and be part of it, right?
Yeah, and then that also goes back to what I was talking about earlier. Like if you have an open pagoda-style feeder, mm-hmm. this time of year, you're going to get doves and pigeons and maybe some finches.
Right.
So even if they can use it, you may not get the desired results.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know you're not a biologist per se, but how many different types of wild birds are there? So if someone got a bird feeder and they put it out on their patio and in front yard or whatever, and they were had the right stuff out to attract birds, what different kinds of birds could they see could be attracted to that feeder?
Tucson's a very birdie place. Mm-hmm. And you can get a whole lot of species, especially depending on location, without trying too hard. But there's something like 600 species in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
We moved up to the foothills 6 or 7 years ago, And the first year we were there, we stopped counting at over 100 species in the yard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
and there's some pretty spectacular ones. Of course, the red cardinal is pretty obvious, but there's some pretty spectacular birds that come up and feed, and it's a pretty amazing experience, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, we get orioles and tanagers and warblers and all those birds you can get, you know, in your yard.
As birds fly north and south, do you get visitors to come in? Obviously, you're working with, you're feeding the native birds that live in Tucson year-round, but do you get some that pop in for a little bit and then you don't see them again, but maybe you see them again the next year?
Absolutely, yeah. Orioles would be a great example of that. You know, you get them in the spring and the fall, and that's kind of one of the things that makes Tucson so birdy. We're in this weird spot where we have a lot of native birds that are year-round, and then we have a lot of migratory birds.
Right. And so your feeders can't attract those migratory birds. How do they know that the food is, I guess they just know, but how do they know the food is there?
Well, for instance, hummingbirds remember every flower they've ever been to.
Wow.
Yeah.
And they know how to go back and see if it's still there. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just...
So the term bird brain really isn't appropriate, is it?
Because birds are smart.
Yeah.
Yeah. They say like ravens are as smart as a kindergarten age human.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah. I got to tell that to my University of Arizona students someday. They're a bunch of bird brains, so they're really smart.
It's a compliment.
Hey, we're going to take a break here. We're with Justin Friedman, who's the owner of the Wild Bird Store on Fort Lowell. We'll be back in just a minute after a few words from some of our wonderful sponsors. Remember, if you've got a father and he needs something for Father's Day, go get a plate-sized cinnamon roll from Young's Donut Shop for Father's Day. You're listening to The Morning Voice on KVOI. My drummer friend over here, Adam, is drumming along to Birdland by Maynard Ferguson. So I saw you tapping over there.
It's a great song.
Yeah. our guest this morning is Justin Friedman, along with his wife, Clarissa. They are the owners of the Wild Bird Store over on Fort Lowell Road. And how do you get the widest variety of wild birds in your garden, in your patio, in your backyard or front yard? How do you get the widest variety of birds?
So it's by putting out a wide variety of food. Different species eat different things, and you can attract different species by providing different things. So, for instance, cardinals like sunflowers and safflower, they like seeds, but they don't like grains so much. So if you buy, you know, a traditional bird seed from the grocery store, there's a good chance it's going to be really full of grains. And the only birds that really eat those are dove, pigeon, quail. So putting out the right kind of seeds will definitely tailor what kind of birds you can get. And then there's other types of foods to attract a whole other array of birds. Different types of nut and fruit and insect and suet type of products will all kind of garner different birds.
Right. So you can help people with that. You sell seeds and feed at the store, so they can come in and you kind of walk them through that as to what the varieties they could get. If they use this type of seed, they see these kind of birds. And
correct.
And some people like dove, so you can also teach them how to feed dove.
Definitely.
Exclusively. Right?
Yeah. Not exclusively.
Not exclusively.
Yeah.
Because the pigeons will come too, right?
Yeah, if you're feeding doves, you're getting other stuff too.
The javelina will come too, right?
No, we can help you stop that from happening.
Yeah.
If you put out, a seed feeder, you can be looking for songbirds like cardinals, paraloxia, finches, sparrows, maybe towhees and buntings and grosbeaks. If you put out we make these cylinders that are really compressed nut and fruit and seed blocks. Some of them have insects, and they get woodpeckers and thrashers and cactus wrens and mockingbirds
who have to work at it to get the seed off of the pressed thing, right?
Yeah, and those are really great too because they're inexpensive and long lasting, and you get really cool birds to them.
That's great. That's great. So when people come into your store, we were talking about the look through the window thing at the guy working back there in the back. You have a workshop back there. You're building the bird feeders, and they can actually see you working on those.
Yeah.
And some people, you'll go buy some things, but then they'll stay and watch you for a little while. So you're actually a craftsman back there building some of these birdhouses, right?
Yeah, we have a full wood shop. We have a manufacturing facility for food. And that's where, all the magic happens.
So who's your typical customer? You have customers coming from all over Southern Arizona, people who want to attract wild birds to their homes and businesses and so forth. So who's your typical customer?
So our audience has really expanded. I think since the pandemic, a lot more people have found bird feeding and bird watching or something that you can do at home, which was important then. Mm-hmm. A lot of people started then and didn't stop. So I think traditionally, previously, our audience was maybe wealthier and right. higher educated. And, it was definitely a smaller audience. Mm-hmm. And now everybody does it. We have right. customers from all walks of life. And, we have, a wide range.
If you like wildlife and you like beautiful colors and you like to see wildlife doing its thing, it's kind of a neat thing to do, especially if you're all year round you can do it, but it's great at 5 o'clock in the morning to go sit on your patio and watch the birds come in and feed. It's kind of cool, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, people found it and they found out they love it.
Right,
yeah.
right. So you also sell a lot of things like bird fountains and accessories, and we talked about seed and feed and so forth. So you're a full service wild bird store. So if someone doesn't know anything about how do I get started in the wild bird attraction business to get some wild birds on my property, you can walk them through the whole thing, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what we do. I mean, in addition to making stuff and providing stuff that's not available elsewhere and
right.
Curating a nice selection so that you can create a nice space mm-hmm. in your backyard, we also are full of information and are happy to talk to people.
Yeah. And maybe there's one feeder in one area of your yard and another one in a different area, and you get different species in different places depending on what you're feeding them, right?
Yeah. I mean, you can do it all pretty close together if you have a small yard. You mm-hmm. know, you can put your different types of foods and feeders together. But if you can give, your different feeders 10 feet from each other, the birds are generally happier.
Yeah, that's great. So they bring a lot of enjoyment. Where are you located? Where's your store? Wild Bird Store is located where?
3160 East Fort Lowell. Fort Lowell and Country Club.
Yep. And tell us when you're open.
We are open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 o'clock to 5 o'clock.
Great. And not closed on Father's Day, so you're going to go get some young donuts tomorrow and have them for Father's Day.
You know, I just got a shout out for the blueberry cake. Blueberry cake donut from Young's Donut.
It's delicious, isn't it? And what's your website?
Website is wildbirdsonline.com.
And so if people are on Facebook and are listening to this from somewhere else other than Tucson, you certainly can get a hold of you and you can get them the products that they need.
Definitely.
Ship them to them and tell them what they need and wherever they're living. If they're living in Ajo or Wilcox or they're living somewhere else in some other place in the country, you know about what will work there as well, right?
Yes and no. Yeah. If you call me from Maine, I may not know exactly what birds are getting.
Yeah. But you can try, right?
We can try, yeah.
So this segment is called Business Success. Of course, your family's been doing this for a long time, and you've been now doing it for a long time, you and Clarissa. How do you define success?
So in as much as we have it, I define it as some amount of happiness and an ability to have a full life.
That's great.
So
you get bring a lot of enjoyment to people when they come in, and then they have birds come to their home. It's pretty cool, isn't it?
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Justin Friedman from the Wild Bird Store. You're listening to The Morning Voice. We'll be back after the break with Wonder from the University of Arizona. This is The Morning Voice. Welcome to The Morning Voice on this Friday. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. You can see us on Facebook. Where do they go, Matt, to get on Facebook?
1030 The Voice is our Facebook page, and they can see our voice today.
They can see our voice. This is great. So if you're interested in seeing what our guests look like, you can, what I look like, what tie I'm wearing today. I always wear ties.
Always.
And so people always want to know what tie I'm wearing. So go to Facebook and you can always listen to the show after the fact on the KVOI podcast. It's also on the Ackerley Advertising website. So if you miss something today and want to hear about it later, you can go and listen to it there. On Fridays, we talk about the good things happening at the University of Arizona. Of course, yesterday, the Board of Regents was meeting on the campus. It was kind of cordoned off in a couple places. A lot of decisions being made about the three universities and U of A is progressing along in a positive direction, so things are looking good. We call this segment Wonder because we talk about those good things that are happening at the U of A. We can hear about all the bad things going on in the city and the county and the state and at the university. Almost every day there's something somewhere that someone wants to say that's bad that's going on. But we'd like to talk about the good things that are going on. And Wonder is sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant on 4th Avenue, our good friends there. We had a great eat and greet with them a couple weeks ago, Andy Motzkin and her crew. If you haven't been to Caruso's Italian Restaurant on 4th Avenue, great place to take Dad for Father's Day. What a wonderful, wonderful, delicious restaurant. And our very good friends at Hughes Federal Credit Union are stepped up for a major sponsorship through the end of the year here. So we'll have them on the show next week, or 2 weeks, I think it's going to be. We got them coming in to talk about some initiatives they have for Earn and Learn and some other things that they have going on. Our guest for the first segment of Wonder today is Kiera Key Malarkey. She's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Tucson, Arizona. And if you know, the National Weather Service has a building that is on the edge of the University of Arizona campus and interacts quite frequently with the University of Arizona scientists and other people that are learning about weather and so forth. So welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful.
I asked you, did you get the short straw and how did you get to be here? And you said you chose to be here. This is great.
So, yeah, absolutely.
Exciting. So tell us a little bit about Key Malarkey and tell us about your educational and professional journey that landed you at the edge of campus at the University of Arizona at the National Weather Service.
Yeah, I have a bachelor's degree in meteorology, which I acquired in 2021. And then right afterwards, I went into master's school. So I have a master's degree in meteorology, which I graduated in 2023. And then nearing the end of my graduate studies, I applied several offices within the Weather Service and then got accepted and started a week after graduation.
Well, so congratulations.
I just went right into it.
That's
right out of school.
Great. Weather is something that happens every day, so they needed you right away.
Yep.
What they wanted, yeah. So you have a couple focal points with the National Weather Service. You're a focal point for air quality, utilities, and tribal engagement. Then you have a co-focal point of fire weather. What is fire weather?
So fire weather, we usually will study indices such as low relative humidity, high temperatures, strong winds, and then we'll use the National Fire Danger Rating System, which is used by the U.S. Forest Service. They measure fuel moisture, and so taking all of those variables together, knowing the thresholds that this area has, we can understand how severe the weather conditions are that could lead to enhanced fire conditions.
You're not predicting fire or wind fire, but you're saying that the conditions are right for that kind of thing. You're not saying that a fire will break out, but you're saying could break out.
Exactly.
Because of the conditions are just right with humidity and wind and the dryness of our place. So that's a pretty important thing, especially in a place like southern Arizona where you've got even the foothills, which have some big pine trees and stuff. It's important that you know what the weather is there. So that's an interesting. And what is air quality, utilities, and tribal engagement? Tell us about those three responsibilities.
Yeah, so in the National Weather Service, we have a warning coordination meteorologist. Mm-hmm. And this individual's role is mainly to learn and understand the needs of the partners within these respective fields. And now that is quite a vast role. There are lots of people that this person needs to work with. And so that's where a focal point comes into play. And so I've taken on four different realms of the meteorology world to sort of be that person, that point of contact for these partners to come to so that I can help relieve some of the stresses of the warning coordination meteorologist and still provide the support that those partners need so they can accomplish their mission.
So I can see the air quality if you're going to have an inversion and there's going to be some poor air quality. You're working with Pima County Health Department and other people to let them know to stay inside or you wear a mask or whatever. Utilities, they need to know what the weather's going to be like, especially if poles go down or could go down or that. But the tribal engagement, that's an interesting one. What is the focus there? What are you working with them? Obviously, have big nations in our outskirts of southern Arizona, and you're helping them just determine what they need to know about the weather in their particular area.
Yeah, so I work with them to make sure that they know the resources that we can offer for them, and then they can decide which resources they want to utilize that we can offer.
Right. So, naive question, what is meteorology?
So meteorology is the study of weather within the atmosphere. The fun part of meteorology is there are so many branches that someone could specialize in or study further, like air quality or fire weather, or it could even be so micro scale as like a tornado or a hurricane. it is a very vast study.
Mm-hmm. And it's, as I said, around us every day, 24 hours a day. We always have weather. And there's a difference between weather and climate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Climate is a long range, kind of the broad picture over a period of years, decades, centuries even, whereas weather is what's happening right now.
Yep, correct.
Did I get that right?
You did.
Oh, good. I think I got something right. I love myself. Thank me for what I do. So every day, well, one of the reasons you're here is because of the story that appeared about the weather balloons. And every day, you're one of 92 places across the country. The National Weather Service sends up weather balloons. So every day at 10 and 4 p.m., one of your scientists, meteorologists, will launch a balloon. Tell us about that process and why are they doing this?
Yeah, so we launch a weather balloon to obtain high-resolution weather information, starting from the surface all the way up to the top of the atmosphere around 30,000 meters or 100,000 feet. The goal is to collect temperature, humidity, wind speed, and direction throughout the whole atmospheric profile.
So that was interesting to kind of read and hear about this and kind of study a little bit about this. That balloon gets up there. When it gets up really, really high, eventually the balloon pops, right?
Yep. It'll expand based on like the pressure of the atmosphere to about 30 feet in diameter, which is almost the size of a school bus.
Right. So it goes up. It's just, maybe the size of a laundry basket or something like that when it goes up. But then when it gets up there, because of the pressures, mm-hmm. it expands and becomes this huge thing. Eventually it will expand so much it will pop. But when it's up there, it has a little parachute, and down comes, is it called a, how do you say the responder, the radio thing? How do you call that?
It's called a radio sond.
Radio sond. So when the radio sond, that is what's actually giving you the data. That's the little computer that's up there that you've sent up. And you want that back, right?
Actually don't need them back.
Oh, you don't need them back.
Yeah, so when they pop and fall down to the surface, anybody who finds it is welcome to keep it. We don't need it back.
You just don't want it to hit somebody in the head, right?
Of course not, yeah.
And that's why you have these orange parachutes. Mm-hmm. So as they float down to Earth, they have this a little orange parachute. So you see it coming down. Mm-hmm. It's not like, and sometimes they get stuck in trees and other things. But so on the U of A campus, every once in a while, someone might find a probably not, because of the winds would probably carry it quite a ways away.
But, it's possible. We've heard of stories where it lands in Midtown. So it's entirely possible that you could see one here in Tucson.
So why are you going up 100,000 feet or 300, what did you say, 300 meters?
30,000 meters.
Why are you going up that high? Why not higher? Why not lower? Why do you go to that particular height?
That is the height that the balloon could withstand. If mm-hmm. we used bigger balloons, they could go up higher. There are ozone balloons or stratosphere balloons that can go well above the threshold where weather occurs, and they want to study more chemical meteorology, and so they go way higher. But ours mm-hmm. only go up that high.
And they're intended basically to give you the weather for this part of our part of the country.
Yep.
And that's combined with others across the country to give us those weather maps that we see on National Weather. They're being coordinated between all those different sites. So there's balloons going up today at 10 or whatever. They go up all over the country, not at the same time per se, but mm-hmm. They're going up all over the country. So, well, our guest this morning is Kee Malarkey. She is a meteorologist at the National Weather Service, located on the EDGE campus at the University of Arizona. That's on the south side of campus. It's on 6th Street and
Park.
And so it's that National Weather Service. I think it's called, isn't it called the Dennis D. Cassini Building? Or there's one near it called that. It's right there on the corner of Park and the 6th Street on the red brick building, like all of them are over there. And so you're actually part of the campus, even though you're not part of the campus per se. It's that's why we say it's on the edge of campus, because the National Weather Service is obviously a standalone federal agency that coordinates all of this. But there's this synergy that's happening with the U of A. We'll talk about that when we get back, about how the National Weather Service works with the college and the scientists at the University of Arizona. We're listening to Wonder on The Morning Voice. Wonder is about good stories at the University of Arizona, and it's sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant on 4th Avenue and Hughes Federal Credit Union. We'll be back after the break with more on The Morning Voice.
Sorry, man. That's what we're dealing with.
I love it. Saturday, 106. Sunday, 110. We got a heat wave coming. And guess what? The National Weather Service predicted that, Matt.
It's they did.
Amazing how they predicted that. We're talking weather. We're talking
one causal factor. It's June.
Yeah, and it's hot in Tucson, but it's a dry heat. It's a dry heat, as they say. Our guest for Wonder is Kee Malarkey. She is a meteorologist at the National Weather Service located at the edge of campus at the University of Arizona. So, well, welcome back, Kee.
Thank you.
Yeah, those balloons go up every day at 10 and 4. And we happen to live close, obviously, to we have a international airport, which has 3 or 4 or 5 runways out there. But we also have something called the Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. So we have a lot of planes that fly over the University of Arizona area where you're launching these balloons. So how do you coordinate with Davis-Monthan when you're sending up a balloon that high?
So we actually don't have to. Within the Weather Service, the rule is 5 nautical miles. Mm-hmm. But just as a courtesy, because they do have flight paths that will go directly over a building, we'll give them a heads up just to let them know that we're going to launch a balloon, and then they can decide how they want to move forward from there.
Right, right. So they can aim at it, or they can go around it, depending on what they're practicing that particular day, right? So so the instrument, as it goes up, it's got a little computer on it, basically. It's got GPS. You know where it is up in the sky, and it's triangulated by the satellites, probably, to tell you where it is. And then that balloon expands, and the wind will move it one way or another, depending on where the prevailing winds are going. So, but it goes up 100,000 feet is a long ways up. And so it is kind of giving you readings all the way up, and then while it's up there, how long does it stay up there before the balloon expands so much that it pops?
For about 2 hours.
About 2 hours. So you get a lot of readings from that.
Yes.
And as things change, you're getting that kind of instantaneous change and so forth. You would think, you know, I'm just a novice. I don't know anything about weather balloons, but you would think in 2025, with the burgeoning of AI and young people at the university who are smart, and that we would have invented a drone or something else that would go up. Why are we still using weather balloons 30, 40, 50 years after they first went up? Why is it still the gold standard for getting daily weather reports?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, actually. So they're actually fairly cost-effective when it comes to the other methods that could be used, but there are other things that could impact it, like a drone. The propeller wind could actually influence the wind speed or direction of the measurements that the radio sound would pick up. Maybe like larger aircraft, it could emit heat, and right, that could also impact the data.
Very interesting. Yeah,
yeah, but there are other methods.
And satellites, they have to be too high up, though. They would be too far away to maybe give you the reading that you need a little closer to the surface, right?
So they do provide us some supplementary information, but the balloon.
But they're looking at it, no pun intended, but from the 10,000-foot level, the satellite is looking at it more from a global perspective or a area perspective, whereas the balloon is really specifically, here's the weather in Tucson, basically.
Yes, yep, it's a tried and true, and it really is the best way to do it still. Yeah.
So it's a daily ritual. One of your scientists, 5 days a week, right? You don't do it on weekends?
Nope,
Single, you do it every single day. Christmas, Easter?
Every single day.
Thanksgiving, someone's up there on the roof launching a balloon and then reading the, coordinating the data that's coming in on the computers and so forth. And you feed the National Weather Service then, feeds that information to a variety of different places, whether it would be, for instance, the FAA regarding wind shear at airports, or whether it go to the local TV stations would grab that information for their 10 o'clock weathercast and so forth. So it goes, once the information is gathered, it's then disseminated to a bunch of different people, right?
Yeah.
Different places, and different organizations use it for different reasons. But you're developing this public informational base that people can access and know what's going on in Tucson. So it's really important that you do it every day, and that everyone, sometimes Bill and I laugh that during the monsoon season in Tucson, we lead on some of the local newscasts with, it's raining outside. Okay, it's the monsoon, and it's Tucson, and it rains every year at this time. But I guess we're going to lead with that story. So that's great. So you are part of Wonder, and Wonder is about the good things that are going on at the University of Arizona. And I'd like to ask our guests on Friday, what's one thing at the University of Arizona that you think falls into that category of wonder?
The curiosity that students have. They have the most wonderful questions that they ask that really makes me think about my studies and my experiences. And it just really, it makes me question, you know, maybe I do something different this time and learn more about what they're interested in. that's the curiosity of students.
That's really cool, that whole quest for knowledge and, mm-hmm. and learning and absorbing. You have an intern with you today who wanted to be quiet and just be observing. But, you know, interns are really important to give them that curiosity, satisfy that curiosity. And then you work with scientists at the University of Arizona and with students at the University of Arizona developing programs for them to help them be exposed to meteorology and how that all works. It's a pretty robust relationship with the U of A, obviously being right there on campus, right?
Yeah, we have a really great relationship with the Department of Hydrology and Atmospheric Sciences.
And so they're teaching kids how to become meteorologists, and they're learning on, and then they come over to the National Weather Service and actually see you guys in action. And I bet some of them have been on the roof when a balloon's been launched.
So they absolutely have, yep.
Yeah, they can see that whole process as it unfolds. Well, that's great. Well, keep hanging balloons off of the roof at the National Weather Service in Tucson so that we know where we are, because the weather's not predictable, and we like to know what's happening and when it's going to be happening. So special thanks to Key Malarkey, a meteorologist at the National Weather Service, located, we call it, on the edge of campus at 6th Street and Park Avenue. If you see a weather balloon in the sky, it came from the National Weather Service, so that's really cool. So thank you for being here this morning. We really appreciate it. We would like to remind you that this is Father's Day weekend. If you're looking for something special for Father's Day, go get a plate-size cinnamon roll from Young's Donut Shop, Rise and Shine at Speedway and Kolb. I was there this morning, and oh my goodness gracious, I'm talking, it's the size of a dinner plate. It's amazing, and your dad would love it. And of course, we have the Bowl-a-thon coming tomorrow at 10 to 12 at Lucky Strike Bowl, 4015 East Speedway. If you're not a bowler and you just want to come have some fun and bid on some auction items, or just come and drop off a check for us, we'd appreciate that. So come between 10 and 12 tomorrow, Lucky Strike Bowl. And then our next eat and greet is this month. This will be Thursday, June 26th. From 5:30 to 7 at Casa del Rio Restaurant and Cantina. The Morning Voice host will be there, and Matt Neely, myself, maybe Adam, maybe Bill will be there, and we'll enjoy some margaritas.
There you go.
That'll be fun.
That sounds
huh?
good.
Yeah, sounds good.
So, looks like you might have a minute or two left.
Yeah.
Can I get a go back?
You can.
I'm so glad she's here. She should come back more often because this is really fascinating stuff. So what's the outlook you guys are getting on your trending from the Climate Center on how the monsoon is shaping up? Because, and you can explain to the folks why we started on the 15th versus the three consecutive dew point days. But maybe you can let us know what you guys are seeing and how things are shaping up this time.
Yeah. So to answer the initial question about the June 15th through September 30th, we just... not arbitrarily, but we chose that based on climatology of when thunderstorms typically occur during the monsoon season, instead of using the three-day dew point rule. In terms of the monsoon outlook, it's actually looking promising if you like weather, like precipitation. We are leaning above normal precipitation this summer based on climatology of this past winter. We've studied that when we have extraordinarily dry winters, it tends to lead towards a more wetter monsoon season. So that's encouraging.
Does El Nino and La Nina, I know that La Nina affects winter rains. Do those two phenomena affect or influence the summer monsoon cycle?
Not as much. It definitely has more of an impact in the winter season, but much more minimal in the summer seasons.
Interesting. It's nice to talk to a meteorologist who knows what they're talking about, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's pretty amazing.
So to me, that's just, well, you know, I'm spewing, just, you know, guessing probably.
Yeah, well, you know, when we tell people that it's raining, we just go to the front door and look outside
and see
if it's raining. And that's
the old Les Nessman eyewitness weather.
Yeah, eyewitness weather.
I went out and looked out the window,
Yeah. What is it? It's going to be a sunny today and dark tonight. That's what we think.
Thank you, George.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, by the way, I see your shirt, and kudos to Brian Wilson.
I got the pleasure of seeing him in 2017 at the U of A. That talk about wonder. They performed the Pet Sounds album in its entirety in sequence.
Oh, fantastic.
And it was really special. And now I'm just glad I got
Key,
to see
do you
him
know
once.
Who Brian Wilson is from the Beach Boys?
Don't.
We were Bill and I were talking about this. There were some reporters on the local TV news this morning, and they were talking about Brian Wilson passing, and they did not know who he was. Do you know who Brian Wilson is?
Listening to them this morning.
Okay. Do you know? Of course, you know, Adam knows.
I have a little history.
Yeah, you have a little history with them, so. and I, pretty amazing that you're going to put them up. Are you putting them up right now? Were you putting? Oh, I thought you were putting up Brian Wilson.
This one's specifically for Adam because I've heard him play this multiple times at the Gaslight Theater, and I, so this one's going out specifically for you because it's always nice to hear you and the band play this before the show. So as a warm up.
Awesome, yeah. Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Morning Voice. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. On Fridays, we talk about the good things happening at the University of Arizona, and we call it Wonder. A shout out to my good friend, Caleb Simmons, who was just appointed as Vice Provost of the University of Arizona. So he's been a friend of mine since he was an instructor at the Religious Studies program. He's been in on Jump in Tucson. We had him in here. He's the director, executive director of Arizona Online as well, but he just got promoted to being one of the 87 vice provosts. And I'm just teasing. I was teasing him about that yesterday. So, but he's a great guy and had a nice meeting with him yesterday. And congratulations to him. Wonder is sponsored by Crusoe's Italian Restaurant on 4th Avenue and our good friends at Hughes Federal Credit Union. They're wonderful. You'll begin hearing their spots on The Morning Voice starting on right away, so as we talk about that. Our guest for this segment is Dr. Tanya Quist. She's the director of the University of Arizona Campus Arboretum. She's in the Department of Plant Sciences and the College of Agricultural Life and Environmental Sciences. Welcome and good morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, you have an interesting appointment. You are a person that oversees the Arboretum, but you also... talk about plants a lot to people, right?
Yeah, yeah, I wear many hats.
Yeah. So tell us about how you got from Purdue University and got to the University of Arizona.
Bigger story than that. So I'm actually originally from Eastern Canada, Nova Scotia.
Oh, yeah.
So I felt like being surrounded by plants. I think it rains something like 300 days a year there.
Right.
So being surrounded by plants, I had no choice.
And it doesn't rain 360 days a year.
Exactly. It's so, like day and night, literally.
Exactly.
But I just felt like I had no choice except to study plant science. Botany was kind of my thing from an early age. And so I... eventually decided that what was really interesting is how plants deal with stress.
Mm.
So I went to Purdue University and I studied that topic and was really interested in that and loved research. But I really felt like there is a need to educate students and also to put research to work. So right. The position at the University of Arizona just allowed me to combine all of those interests.
That's great.
And seemed like the perfect situation for someone who wants to work with students in a place that has a great need to understand environmental stress in plants.
That's very cool. You know, we like Purdue because our president, Goresh Garmella, is from Purdue. He was there for a while before he was on to Vermont. And then my boss at the Eller College of Management, Karthik, is from, was at Purdue for a while as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, so. lots of great minds came out of Purdue.
Yeah. So you were also director of the University of Arizona Campus Arboretum. What is an arboretum and what does that mean?
Yeah, good question. It's a question I get all the time. So I think about the arboretum in more general terms as a public garden. So the term public garden implies that the garden is intended to bring people together with plants. So with an arboretum, arbor refers to trees, it's a public garden that focuses on the collection, the care, the use of trees or woody plants for public good.
And so it's not in a building, it's not in a museum, it's not... confined to one little gated area somewhere.
Yes.
Where is it?
Yeah, so I liked your idea of making the analogy of a museum because it is a museum collection.
Right.
But you can think about the Arboretum as a living museum, or in other words, a museum where all of the specimens or the accessions in the collection are living plants. And typically, universities have an arboretum, but it's generally somewhere located off-site. So it's like a separate space where people have to leave their educational experience or leave their community and move and go into the garden that's somewhere else. We have kind of a cool situation with the campus arboretum in that the garden has been brought to the campus. So that creates some challenges because there's a lot of different people who have ideas about how the campus landscape should be used. But it has a tremendous it provides a tremendous opportunity because it's bringing the garden to where the people have already congregated with the purpose of learning.
So there are trees basically dotted all over campus. A lot of them are concentrated, not a lot of them, but many of them, and some of them are concentrated down by Old Main along some of those older buildings and so forth, because they're huge trees. Some of those have been there a long, long time. But there are also other places as well. So where, if someone was to go look at the Arboretum and walk around and look at the trees and get that tour, how many places would they go?
They would go everywhere. Mm-hmm. So the campus arboretum includes all of the woody plants that are on the nearly 400 acres okay. of main campus.
So if it's a tree and it's on the campus, it's part of the arboretum then, basically.
If it's a woody plant. So right. if it's a tree, a shrub, or a saguaro, or something that has some woody structure, it's included in the collection. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Yeah, mm-hmm. I was telling you earlier, we have a couple of three sons, and one of my sons was going to head off to the Tucson Boys Chorus International Tour, and he was, you know, first in seniority, and the thing wasn't due, his report wasn't due until he got back, but he tells me about this on a Sunday, and they're leaving on a Monday, and so we went down to the Arboretum, and we did the tour, and he got a leaf from each one, and there's these little plaques that describe, that
That's get, right.
it gives it the genus name or whatever.
The plant species name.
Yeah, so it has what it is, but what we call them, like we call it like a big green tree, and then it has that name, and then it tells you what the actual name is, and so those are pretty cool around campus. It's kind of like a museum.
Yeah.
It's telling you what it is.
Yeah, it's interpreting. It's intended to teach you more about what you're looking at so you have a richer experience. And it's awesome that, you know, a young person can go there and not just learn the identity of the plants. It's like if I didn't know your name, we wouldn't, you know, there's right. no basis to really develop a more full relationship. So the Campus Arboretum actually includes almost 20,000 accessions, and they represent 1,300 unique different species from six continents.
Right.
So basically anyone who comes here from anywhere in the world is likely to find something that's from their place of origin. So I kind of like that layer to the diversity mm-hmm. too, where there's something that is for everyone.
And that's interesting because we're not just talking about trees that are native to Tucson and southern Arizona. We're talking about all different kinds of species that come in, and you guys put them in places where they grow and thrive and be accessible to people to see.
Right. I mean, I think it's absolutely important to promote understanding of our native plants and to plant them. But if you think about how different a built environment is from our natural mm-hmm. setting here, we need to think beyond that, because in some situations in an urban context, where there's microclimates, there might be places where it's hotter or colder or wetter or drier, a plant that's from somewhere else might have something new to offer or be better adapted.
Mm-hmm. And so you've talked a little bit about the mission of the Arboretum and so forth. As director, what are your responsibilities? You don't go around and trim the trees and pick up the leaves and all that. So what does that director do that is in charge of that whole process?
Yeah, so I'll answer that, but I'll start by just giving a little backstory to how this collection came to be, you know, plants mm-hmm. from all around the world. And, you know, it's rooted in our mission as
rooted. I know she said rooted.
Yeah. Okay, there'll like be that. Lots more botanical puns.
Okay, okay.
We'll try.
Leave me alone. Yeah. Come on. We'll branch out into some other subjects, I'm sure. But
cross-pollinates will come up somewhere.
Exactly.
So the University of Arizona is a land-grant institution, and that means that we, like other universities, provide research and education, but we also have an outreach component. Mm-hmm. And the outreach component essentially breathes life into our research and education. It means that our research has to be targeted or aiming to address problems that are of need for the state, and that our education has to be extended out. So because of that mission, from the very beginning, faculty at the U of A have an interest in solving problems. And in those early years, the problem was like, what are we going to eat? Mm-hmm. How are we going to make a living here? How are we going to become a state? So many of those researchers went out around the world and brought back plants from other arid climates and planted them on campus with the idea of like testing to see how they would perform in this climate. And then those that were successful were introduced out into the trade as commodity crops. So things like citrus and dates and cotton mm-hmm. came from the U of A. But, you know, again, that mission persists. And so into the mid 20th century, you know, there's a lot of people moving to the Southwest and a lot more concern about how we're going to provide water and other resources for a growing urban population. So the research shifted to look for amenity trees. So landscape ornamental trees were then the, you know, going out, trying to find those from arid climates, bringing them back, planting them on campus and testing to see how they performed. And those trees, I mean, this work yielded all these commodity crops and an economic base for Arizona, but it also provided landscape ornamentals that are now distributed throughout the arid Southwest. So even in Santa Barbara, we just got back from California and saw jacaranda trees everywhere there, those beautiful purple flowered trees. And they were brought to the U.S. by faculty and the College of Agriculture at the time. So I think the impact is pretty impressive. And what's also kind of cool is that the plants that weren't deemed to be like super adapted to application generally, we still have them on campus. So we have all these kind of oddballs and weirdos,
it's kind of cool to see them too. Yeah,
it catches attention. And so I think once you have someone's attention, you have a basis to start teaching more about maybe what are better choices and how to manage urban landscapes. So what do I do? So,
well, let's hold there because we'll come back after the break. We're talking with Dr. Tanya Quist. She's the director of the University of Arizona Campus Arboretum. We'll have to take a quick break here. We'll come back and we'll ask you what you do, and then we'll talk a little bit more about what people can do to go see the trees on campus.
Okay.
You're listening to The Morning Voice on KVOI.
A little bit of The Trees by Rush.
Welcome back to Norwegian Wood from the Beatles. That's great. We're speaking with Dr. Tanya Quist, who's the director of the University of Arizona Campus Arboretum. So let's talk a little bit about your responsibilities, the mission, and your outreach of what you guys do in terms of getting the community involved.
Yeah, so the Campus Arboretum is a living laboratory with the goal of promoting stewardship and conservation of urban trees. So in practice, the Arboretum, the collection of trees on campus, is really intended to serve as a conduit for science, to get science from the university out into the community. And the primary focus of that is to inform plant selection choices, landscape development, and management practices that ensure that the trees are not just going to be planted, but that they'll live and thrive a long time and provide all sorts of benefits. So my role as the director of the Campus Arboretum, my primary role is to curate the collection. In other words, to apply science in considering what plants should be selected, where they should be placed, and then also trying to source those plants, trying to get plants that maybe aren't from here, to plant on campus. So the overarching goal is really to make sure that the landscape is built with intention, to make sure that there's like a clear purpose and rigorous consideration. And again, like that's the way that the Arboretum adds like educational value to the collection, to the landscape. So some of the ways that the Arboretum does that, some of the things that I contribute as director, is to provide standards and guidance, to keep records that support decisions. Without information, you can't know where you're going or how to get there. So some of the standards and goals and records that are of interest to the Arboretum are things like, what's the diversity of the collection? So if we only have mesquites, there's probably benefits that other trees are could provide that aren't there to provide. Maybe there's things that could be better adapted. Canopy cover, how much shade canopy do we have? Planning for the future, succession planning. So when one tree is no longer suited, what is a better tree that's going to take its place? Culling invasives, and then primarily like planting climate-ready species. So in addition to that, though, which I think is so amazing about the Arboretum, not only is it inclusive of the whole campus, but it touches so many different aspects of the university. So the Arboretum collaborates with everyone, primarily with the operations. So there's kind of the academic programs, and then there's the operations. And with operations, the Arboretum provides guidance during landscape development. So when a building is going to be constructed or a garden is going to be developed, the Arboretum provides guidance on what plants to choose and how to manage that site. Always encouraging innovation too, because, you know, sometimes operations is just budget stretched and You know, sometimes the easiest thing to do is just what has been done in the past. So encouraging innovation, especially, you know, adoption of technology to manage those records. Currently, we're partnering with the operations to do a landscape master plan. The best part of my job, though, is the outreach. So working with students, working with the community. We work with the Pima County Master Gardeners who do tours. Mm-hmm. We work, recently we did collaborations on campus with the Center for Integrative Medicine for Natural Resources with the College of Planning Landscape Architecture. And we even did a partnership with Lunar and Planetary Sciences. So just to give a broad perspective about how many programs the Arboretum connects with. And then outside, we've worked with Tohono O'Toole, Tucson Botanic Garden, Desert Museum. And in every instance, when I say we, I mean the Arboretum, me as a director, but also staff and primarily students. So we have kind of merged my instructional activities with some of the Arboretum project so that the students have an opportunity to gain experiential learning opportunities through service learning. So it's a way of like taking them out of the classroom and asking them to kind of develop those social skills that give them some ability to select what's appropriate with knowledge for the audience. So I think that's a really important skill that, you know, is far beyond what you just get from content delivery in the classroom.
Yeah, that's great. And how can the listener get engaged and go see the Arboretum? And it's free because it's outside. So how do they go and get a tour and those kind of things?
So many opportunities for outreach. So again, many of these opportunities have been created by students for the community. The tours are among those. So the students created the tours. The master gardeners deliver them. The students have been involved in building these campus learning gardens, places where there's like an opportunity to interpret the meaning or some important lesson from the campus landscape. Occasionally we have events. So coming up August 1st, the Arboretum tour program for the next academic year, so that registration will open then. And best way to access that is to just go to arboretum.arizona.edu to go to the Arboretum's website. And under Find Trees and Tours, you'll find all sorts of information about guided tours. But we're really excited because now we have layers, too, that bring the campus to the people through virtual experiences. So the students currently are working on mobile and virtual tours so that you don't necessarily have to be physically present on campus to learn about all of this.
That's great. Thank you, Dr. Tanya Quist, the director of the University of Arizona Arboretum. This is The Morning Voice. Have a good weekend and enjoy the heat, and happy Father's Day to all of our fathers.